Thanks, Pat. Jonah crashed his van. It's a really interesting passage. Well, I come very jet lagged this morning. I just couldn't get to sleep last night. I'm on 3 hours sleep, and it's been like that for a few nights running. I've worked so hard on this sermon, but I feel like I'm hardly here. So here goes. It's a wonderful two chapters. I had a conversation with a man in our church a few weeks ago who's a respected member of our congregation who said that I could share our conversation. And he said, and he wasn't complaining, he's wondering whether or not the preaching has been too relentlessly about mission. And a few other people had been wondering as well, and it was a very helpful conversation, whether or not the preaching had been too much about mission and the Christian life, there's a lot of other things in the Christian life apart from mission, and that these things need to be attended to in the preaching. It was a very helpful conversation. So for the rest of the week, I started to reflect on that. So the first thing I want to say is it was a really helpful conversation, and I did and am listening. And I'm going to push it against it a bit as well. So during that week, I started to reflect, and then Heather posted online the title of this new sermon series. And it has mission in the title. And I saw it online, and I thought, here I go again. It's mission again. I thought, he's dead right. This is my hobby horse, and maybe I'm flogging a dead horse. And then, so I felt pretty bad and pretty aware of that. And then a few days later, I thought to myself, well, actually, I didn't choose these three books because they're about the mission of God. I chose them for other reasons. I chose Jonah, Obadiah, and Micah because they're minor prophets at the end of the Old Testament, and we want to kind of look at the scope of the Bible, and so that's why we chose them. And they just happened to be about mission. So I slept better that night. But then my next thought was, it actually makes sense though, doesn't it, that Jonah, Micah, and Obadiah are about mission, when you think about it. Because isn't Genesis to Revelation, the scope of the Bible, the story of God redeeming the world to himself, ultimately through Christ, his death and resurrection? That from Genesis 3, when sin comes into the world, God sets out on a long plan of redemption, calls a people to call attention to his sovereign saving rule. That ends in the biblical story in Revelation, and we await for Christ's return. And so every part of the biblical story then is about God's mission and also about him calling a people to live into that story and live as a contrast people, calling attention to him. And so as we preached, for example, on the Gospels just before Easter, and what we were eating our way through the Gospels and the radical welcome of Christ, it had that missional dimension. Or Genesis 1 to 3, what we call that series, Loving the World to Life, God's Heart for His World, has a missional dimension. I mean, after this series, we'll do marriage and singleness for a few sermons. But even that has a missional dimension, doesn't it? The shape of our friendships, the shape of our marriages, being a testimony to the world of Christ's sovereign saving rule. So I'm pushing against it there by appealing to the biblical story. But yet I need to say again, it was a really helpful conversation and I'm listening. So let's then get stuck into the second half of the book of Jonah, having said that. And the story so far, of course, is Jonah is called to go to Nineveh. And you can see there, can you see on the map there, on the far right-hand side, Israel? Can you see the map clearly enough there? Is it dark enough? And Nineveh is going to the northeast, and it's an overland route. That's what Jonah is called to, an overland route from Israel to Nineveh. And you can see he actually goes down to Joppa, which is that coastal town there, and Joppa is the wrong way to Nineveh. But let's just say this, that Nineveh is the capital of Assyria, and Assyria in Jonah's day was powerful. But 50 years after Jonah's time, Nineveh, the capital of Assyria, would rule the world and would conquer half of Israel. So it's not without reason that Jonah has a bit of a grudge against Nineveh, which is soon to become the international global powerhouse. But he goes to Joppa, the coastal city, and he sets out for Tarshish on the far left of the screen. Tarshish, if anywhere is Tarshish, we're not exactly sure where it is. It's on the east coast of Spain, on the far left of the map. You can't really get further from Nineveh than Tarshish. But we know that God interrupts his sea escape. He brings a storm. And then by Jonah's own instruction, some mariners throw him overboard. He's swirling around in the waves, and he's delivered by a fish, which may not sound like a deliverance, but it is. And there inside the belly of the fish, the great fish, he prays a prayer of thanksgiving, which is that prayer, that song that we looked at last week with Ed Gerber. And I got to read that sermon. He emailed it to me, and it was terrific. And then that great fish spews him up onto dry land, spews him up onto the beach. And here on the beach, God sends Jonah a second time. And we read it here in chapter 3, verse 2, if you'd have a look. It's very interesting. See if you can watch for the nuance. Go to the great city of Nineveh, God says, and proclaim to it the message I give you. Now just watch those words, because that repeats chapter 1 verse 2, which is Jonah's first commissioning, and there's a nuance, a slight change. Let's just read 1 verse 2. Go to the great city of Nineveh and preach, watch this, against it. In chapter 3, it's preach to it, and here it's preach against it. Now, Hebrew works with those kind of nuances. This is the way the Old Testament works. This is the fun of doing a PhD on the Old Testament. These little word changes are huge in the Old Testament. It's the way it works. And it moves from preach against Nineveh in chapter 1 to his second commissioning in chapter 3, preach to Nineveh. It's a softening. From God's pushing against Nineveh to a softening, to a colour, a tone of grace. And that change in preposition is flagging for us, being astute readers of the Old Testament, where this story is going to go. It's flagging that God is going to show grace to Nineveh. It's flagging where the story is going to go. But that's very interesting, because it's also flagging the future of the history of the world. It's flagging God's heart, not just for the Syrians, but for the nations. And here's why. If you know the Old Testament prophets a bit, you'll recognize that Jonah here stands for Israel. The story actually isn't really about Jonah and Assyria. It's kind of a metaphor for the whole nation of Israel and their role to be a light to the nations. The whole point of God's calling Israel is this, that she lives such a beautiful life with her practice of justice and the compassion of Yahweh, her God, that Israel is magnetic and the nations stream. That's the whole idea. And this story of Jonah is as much as asking, is Israel going to be faithful to her calling? Is Jonah going to be faithful to his calling? Just to illustrate, so you know I'm not talking out of my hat, just fly back to Isaiah. It's about 80 pages back. Isaiah chapter 60. This is one of my favorite verses in the world, in the Bible, rather. Isaiah 60. From verse 9. And we're looking at Israel as a light to the nations. Isaiah 60, verse 9. We're looking at Israel being attracted to the nations being attracted to Israel's magnetism. Isaiah 60, verse 9. Surely the islands look to me, God says. In the lead are the ships of Tarshish. There's Tarshish from Spain. Bringing your sons from afar with their silver and gold to the honor of the Lord your God, the Holy One of Israel, for he has made you beautiful. That's what it says in the original. For he has made you beautiful. What a description of the mission of the church. The nations will come. For he has made you beautiful. Is Jonah going to live into that? Just keep your finger in Jonah and flip forward 25 pages or so to Matthew's Gospel, Matthew chapter 5, and a very similar thing that God says, Jesus says to his followers, Matthew 5, to Isaiah, he has made you beautiful. The nations will come. We're seeing here the whole story being the story of God calling a people to call attention to his sovereign saving rule. Matthew 5, and we'll go from verse 13. Jesus says to his followers, you are the salt of the earth, but if the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? In verse 14, you are the light of the world. A city on a hill cannot be hidden. That attractive character of God's people, that missional identity of God's people, being a contrast community with God's heart for the nations. Let's just check this wonderful quote out. Mike and Craig just wrote this quote the last couple of months. It's perfect. A central theme in the biblical story is God's election of a people to embody the kingdom, to be a preview of the goal of history, and thus bear witness, 16, to Christ's rule over all of life. 16. And thus to bear witness to Christ's rule over all of life, this constitutes mission. That's central to the biblical story is God's calling of people. Can I just share with you a story that was really joyful in our own lives in Australia? Erin's still in Australia. She flies back on Thursday morning. We walked into our old church, Tregear Presbyterian Church, a couple of Sundays past. And there was a gentleman who lived in our street about five doors down. He is a huge guy, tats and a pigtail. And he looks rough. You wouldn't want to cross him, except he's always smiling. And his name is Luke. He drives a truck, and his truck is always parked in his long driveway at the front. He's a real Mount Druitt character. And I'd invited him to church a number of times and always stopped to chat. He's a very friendly man. And he'd never come. He'd never come to church. And we walked in to church 2 weeks ago, and there was Luke. And so I walked straight up to him. We were late. We kind of came during the second song. And I saw him there, and I rang up, and we embraced one another, which we hadn't done before. And I said, you're coming to church, man? And he said, no, this is my first time. It was just extraordinary. And as it turned out, he'd walked out of his house to the church. All of our houses were close to the church. And he met Belinda and Joan on the road, who he knew from our street, who came to church. And they came to Christ just a couple of years ago. And he said, I'm coming to see Mark. And Belinda and Joan said, oh, Mark lives in Canada now. He's long gone. It was just remarkable. It's just remarkable. And it was really the Lord bringing it all together. And then because we were there, I was able to greet him and to introduce him to a really mature Christian man called Paul Berenger. And Paul's going to, you know, have some coffee with him. And so that was just, I share that because it's God's mission. It's God's story from Genesis to Revelation. And God's doing his work. And when we're willing and open and praying and telling the Lord that we're available, he uses us. He uses his people. And I just want to testify to that. And I want to encourage you that he uses us when we're open. Even though hearts seem hard, he really does. Well, we're in Nineveh. And what is really interesting is you would kind of think that heaps of space in this book of Jonah would be devoted to Nineveh's process, to the Assyrians' process with God, but only about seven verses are about Nineveh. Just chapter 3 is very short, you can see. Chapter 3 is all there is for Nineveh. But what it does say about Nineveh is very significant. It's really intense. Emphatically, Nineveh repented. And we're told that particularly by a proclamation of Nineveh's king. We'll see that. But emphatically, this is the point, Nineveh repents. Okay, so Jonah reluctantly starts to walk through the streets of Nineveh. 40 days, Nineveh, and God will overturn this town. And then it says in verse 5, Have a look at this. The Ninevites believed God. And that is interesting because that's the response Yahweh had always wanted from his own people, Israel, and often didn't get it. And then it says they declared a fast, and all of them, from the greatest to the least, put on sackcloth. And that's interesting. Sackcloth is thick. It's kind of like big bags, old bags of potatoes. Thick, coarse goat's hair. It's uncomfortable, and it's put on as a renouncement of comforts and pleasures. And it's a symbol, isn't it? Wearing thick, coarse sackcloth is a symbol of humility and repentance. It's symbolic. And here is a nation doing what Israel was always supposed to do. This is very significant. And now we come to this king's proclamation. Watch this in verse 6. When the news reached the king of Nineveh, he rose from his throne, took off his royal robes, covered himself with sackcloth, there's the king in sackcloth, and sat down in the dust. Then he issued a proclamation in Nineveh. Here's the king's proclamation. Watch this. By the decree of the king and his nobles, do not let any man or beast or herd or flock taste anything. Do you see the animals being included in this? The animals have to fast too. It's very interesting. Do not let them drink. Just we'll tuck that away, the involvement of the animals. But let man and beast, here's the animals again, be covered with sackcloth. Let everyone call urgently on God. Let them give up their evil ways and their violence. Who knows? God may yet relent with compassion, turn from his serious anger, so that we may not perish. I think verse 9 is beautiful. He says, who knows? God may yet relent. He's not sure if God will be merciful. He's not sure, but he's going to give it a stab. The king, that is. That reminds me of Mark chapter 1's description of the healing of the leper in Mark's gospel. Do you remember the story? Here is Jesus, and the leper approaches Jesus, and the crowd surrounding Jesus makes way for this man with the smell of death on him. And the leper falls at his face, falls at Jesus' feet, and he says, Master, if you are willing, you can make me clean. It's a similar thing. He knows something about Jesus. He knows that Jesus is powerful. If you're willing, you can make me clean. He must have seen Jesus do miracles, seen Jesus raise the dead. He knows Jesus is powerful. But there's something he doesn't know about Jesus. He doesn't know if Jesus is merciful. He doesn't know if Jesus gives a rip. He doesn't know if he cares. And so he says, if you're willing. And it says, filled with compassion, Jesus reached out his hand and touched the man. And I love that. Jesus didn't have to touch him. He could have healed him with a word. I am willing, he said. Be clean. And it's a similar thing here. He says, who knows, verse 9, God may yet relent and with compassion turn from his fierce anger so that we not perish. And then verse 10, here's the answer that the leper gets. Verse 10 of chapter 3, when God saw what they did and how they turned from their evil ways, he had compassion and did not bring upon them the destruction he had threatened. It's really beautiful, isn't it? I'm very interested in this. And I think that the big point of chapter 3, Nineveh's repentance, is this. I think this is the point. The world is ready to receive an authentic witness to Jesus Christ. There's a readiness to receive an authentic witness to Jesus Christ. The world is ready for a community that rejects the idols of consumerism, who embody the radical welcome of Christ, who practice hospitality, generosity, kindness. The world is ready for people to show how to be community and how to make community in our streets and neighborhoods. The joy of relationship. The world is ready for a community who is advocating for justice, who's walking into the workplace with a different step and different priorities, and who are willing to testify to Christ as we do. The world is ready, the message here of Nineveh, the world is ready for a testimony like that in life, word, and deed. And this chapter reminds me very much of Matthew chapter 9, verse 37, where Jesus says, the harvest is plentiful, What an interesting phrase. The harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. Therefore, pray to the Lord of the harvest that he would send more workers into the harvest. The harvest is plentiful. That friend, Paul Berenger, who I mentioned, who's going to chase Luke up, he's a pastor. And Paul is now in my old church as a parishioner. He's retired now. But Paul was out in the country for years. And he preached on this. The harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. And he preached it as a country pastor. And he put it in Australian lingo. He said, it's a bumper crop. This picture of the wheat fields, it's a bumper crop, an Australian farmer will say. The rain's been perfect. The sun's been perfect. It's a bumper crop. The silos are going to be full to overflowing. The world is ready for an authentic testimony to Jesus Christ. The world is ready for a community who lives out of kingdom values. And people like Jonah are going to miss all the fun. I think there's something else that's worth saying at this point too as we speak about the mission of the church. That I think that, how to say it? I think that there is something very offensive in postmodern culture about people who think that their religion is the only way. And so what right does a Christian have to say, you must come to my God? What right does Jonah have to go to Nineveh, to call Nineveh to follow his God? As Richard Dawkins said in Sydney a month ago, you know, the famous atheist from Oxford University in England, it's religions that are exclusive and say that theirs is the only way that is the cause of all the violence and the wars of the last century. It's rubbish. He doesn't know what he's talking about, but that's what he says. But there is something very offensive in postmodernism about it. And I have a number of friends who aren't Christians who have pointed that very strongly at me. What right do we have to offer an exclusive gospel? I think that Richard Dawkins doesn't understand Christianity. And I think as Christians we can misunderstand Christianity too and the shape of it. Verse 8 is very interesting in this chapter. On the lips of the king, he says, let everyone in Nineveh give up on their evil ways and their violence. Let everyone give up on their evil ways and their violence. Now, let me just try and explain. That is talking about justice. Those two Hebrew words are a reference to oppression and exploitation of the poor. And what this is a radical turnaround in Assyrian society. And here is a king with all the power and the wealth saying no more violence, no more injustice. And so Jonah's call to the Assyrians to come to Yahweh isn't saying, my God, not your God. It's not just that. It's much more than that. He's inviting them to come and to live and to walk in a whole new story, a whole new way of living, a way of living that brings life to the world. This is very, very important. When we're saying come to Christ, we're saying come to live into a radical, come and live in a radical new worldview, because the worldview of secular society isn't working anymore. I mean, the last week has been extraordinary. In Africa, there's North and South Sudan, and there is civil war about to just explode once again. And quite possibly, I have a friend in Sudan from Australia right now, tens and thousands of people to be killed. At the same time, in Canada, we have the most rigid immigration and refugee laws before Parliament right now than we've had in the history of Canada, as far as I know. These two things, selfishness in Sudan, selfish parochialism in Canada. As Jeremiah says in Jeremiah 16, the human heart is wicked, is sinful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? Humanity needs help. The world needs a saviour. It needs a God who will bring justice and call people to justice, and that secures for the world a history of justice and offers forgiveness of sins. The world needs a different story. And as we're coming to the world and offering Christ, we're not saying, my God, not your God. It's much more than that. We're offering the world to live into a different story, the story that Jesus Christ has secured through his death and resurrection, forgiveness of sins, and a future of life and of justice. Well, let's see now how Jonah goes. And through Jonah, perhaps see how Israel goes. Jonah chapter 4 tells us how Jonah goes. Jonah chapter 4 from verse 1. But Jonah was greatly displeased and became angry. And just compare that to the verse before, verse 10 of Jonah chapter 3, when God saw what they did and how they turned from their evil ways, he had compassion. And now it says in verse 1 of Jonah chapter 4, but Jonah was greatly displeased and became angry. There's the contrast. And now we'll read the next two verses. And the next two verses is Jonah's anger. And it's interesting to see that 9 times he says, I and me. Jonah is really self-obsessed. Have a look at verse 2 and 3 of Jonah chapter 4. 9 times, I. He prayed to the Lord, O Lord, is this not what I said when I was still at home? This is why I was so quick to flee to Tarshish. I knew that you are a gracious God and compassionate God, slow to anger and abounding in love, a God who relents from sending calamity. Now, O Lord, take away my life, for it is better for me to die than to live. His retreat from mission is also a retreat into self-obsession. But verse 2 and 3 is very dense. It's very, very interesting, verse 2. He is quoting from one of the verses from the Pentateuch, the first 5 books of the Bible, that is closest to the covenant heart of Israel. Did you see it here? Did you notice? He says, I know that you are a gracious and compassionate God, slow to anger and abounding in love, a God who relents from sending calamity. That comes 30 times in the Old Testament. Slow to anger, abounding in love. 30 times. It's the national anthem of Israel. It's that central statement of the covenant. And it starts in Exodus 34. This is very important. Let me just paint you the picture. See if you can just find Exodus 34 while I paint the picture. It's the incident of the golden calf. Israel has just received the Ten Commandments. What a reverent moment. And while Moses is up Sinai, he's got the Ten Commandments in his hands, and Israel is worshipping a golden calf, idolatry, at the beginning of the nation's life. And Moses comes down the mountain, and he sees this golden calf, you remember it, and he smashes the Ten Commandments, furious on God's behalf, rightly so. You remember it? Exodus 34, will you turn with it to Exodus 34 with me? It's so important in the biblical story. And then it says here, God says to Moses, in his grace, he says, chisel out 2 more stone tablets. This is so important. Such mercy, such forgiveness. At the height of idolatry, verse 4, so Moses chiseled out 2 stone tablets like the first ones and went up Mount Sinai early in the morning as the Lord commanded him. And he carried the 2 stone tablets in his hands. Then the Lord came down to him in the cloud, and he stood there with him and proclaimed his name, the Lord. Just keep the idolatry in mind. And he passed in front of Moses, proclaiming, the Lord, the compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, maintaining love to thousands, and forgiving wickedness, rebellion, and sin. Extraordinary, extraordinary mercy. And Jonah knows that mercy of God. He knows it. He quotes it back to God. And he says, I knew you were like this. I knew you were going to forgive. I really love this quote. Jonah is here, however, highly critical of these divine attributes and views them as regrettable weaknesses in the divine makeup. So the absurdity of Jonah's position is displayed. Jonah begrudges the very attributes in God that brought him life. God is gracious. He tells God, God is gracious, and he begrudges it. But here is the point, I think. You can see where the author's going. He's not writing this for Jonah. He's writing this for us. We know God's mercy. We are recipients of the mercy and forgiveness of the covenant. And from Jonah's lips, he's saying, look at the character of God. He's a God of mercy. He's a God of mission. And so, God's people, live into that story. And not to live into God's story of mission is an absurdity. The absurdity we see in Jonah. Do you kind of see that? Does that make sense? Well, we all know what happens next. Jonah is furious. He wants to die. He goes out from the city. He makes a little tent for himself in the hot Middle Eastern sun. And he sits in the tent and he watches the city to see what's going to happen next. And then you remember the story, a climbing plant grows up, God makes it grow, it shades Jonah for a bit, and Jonah's thrilled, and then the climbing plant withers and dies, and I think that's probably symbolic of Israel's own death. And Jonah is furious all over again. And God says, you're furious about a plant that dies, but you don't give a rip about this nation that's perishing. And then in verse 10 and 11, the climax of the whole book, if you'll have a look at it, the Lord says in the final two verses of Jonah, you pity the plant for which you did not labor, nor did you make it grow, which came into being in a night and perished in a night. And should I not pity Nineveh, that great city in which there are more than 120,000 persons who do not know their right hand from their left, and also much cattle? God's heart for the nations, should I not pity this nation and their cattle? So let's now conclude chapters 3 and 4 of Jonah and wrap the whole book up as well. And there's two things I think we want to say about the mission of God from these two chapters. The first is this. We'll come back to those verses in a minute. It's very interesting to me that God's interest is in the whole world. Just think of how the book of Jonah has an interest in the whole world. Did you notice in that last verse, I think the last word of the whole book, did you see it? It's extraordinary. Where is it? Here it is. 120,000 people that can't tell their right hand from their left, and many cattle as well. God's saving, redeeming interest in the cattle of Nineveh. God has pity, not just on the people, but the cattle. But just think further about that. In the book of Jonah, we've seen God's lordship over the storm, God's lordship over the great fish, God's lordship over a climbing plant, certainly God's lordship over the storms and the waves. And that wonderful verse in Jonah chapter 1, where is it? In verse 9 of Jonah chapter 1, he says, I'm a Hebrew and I worship the Lord, the God of the heaven, who made the sea and the land. It's very, very beautiful. God's interest in every aspect of the world. And I read some scholars this week who were really surprised by this. In this beautiful quote they wrote, they say about the book of Jonah, another peculiarity of the book is the pronounced role of flora and fauna in it. As persistent references to plants and animals throughout the book make clear, God's authority extends to all created life and not only to human beings. So I want to say this about the mission of the church, and I've written it up so we can say it carefully. Because Christ's lordship and saving interest extends beyond humanity to the world, the mission of the church extends to the world. That God's sovereign saving interest, and through him our missional interest, is in every aspect of God's world. And so just going to the next quote, I love this quote by Leslie Newbegin, where our mission is in the world. The exercise of the church's priesthood is not within the walls of the church, but in the daily business of the world. It's only in this way that the public life of this world, its accepted habits and assumptions, can be challenged by the gospel and brought under the searching light of the truth as it has been revealed in Jesus. So in the office, in the playgroups and mothers groups and seniors groups, that is where we walk with a different step and by our life, word and deed, call attention to the difference that Christ makes. Here is the second point that I think that we need to make. And I'm going to quote an even more authoritative author than Leslie Newbegin, if we can go to the next quote. She was a school principal, you know. And if we don't do this, she may not have the authority, but she has the will to give out detentions. She still can. Berta said on Friday evening at our leadership training, we have to get out of the whale and get on with the job. And I think that getting on with the job means this. It doesn't mean going into the workplace tomorrow and Bible bashing everyone. I'm a Christian. I think it means rather us coming to attention and reorienting and knowing that the primary identity of God's people in the world as a sent people, and so living in every aspect of our lives distinctively so that there's something different that's come into the office because a follower of Christ is there. And if we could just grab the next slide, please, Joe. One of the most helpful ways I've ever heard of thinking of mission is life, word, and deed. Daryl Guder is the missiologist, I think, who first said this. So can you just think now of what you're going to be doing tomorrow? And think in terms of these three categories of a different kind of life, certainly calling attention with words when appropriate, but different kind of deeds as well. Deeds of justice, deeds of kindness, deeds that are kingdom shaped. And can we just take a couple of minutes now to think about getting out of the whale, getting on with a job in light of these three categories? And can we just take a couple of minutes for silent prayer? And you can pray with your eyes open perhaps and think about your day this tomorrow and this week in life, word, and deed. And just go through each of those categories and pray over it with God. And by life, because it's probably the most confusing one, we're meaning leaving those idolatries, those idols of the workplace. Our first priority is no longer money. It's no longer success. It's no longer even achievement, though we want to be a terrific worker and the best teacher and the best salesperson, for Christ's sake, that we can be. But life means fleeing those idols and living for different goals and different values, embodying in who we are, the kingdom of God. Let's now commit the next 7 days to Christ as the church scattered. Let's pray some silent prayers.